Good afternoon. My name's Hank Herrera. I had to put Henry on the form, so sorry about that. I'm going to describe our project in Oakland called Health for Oakland's People and Environment, or the HOPE Collaborative. And I want to thank Kimmy Watkins-Tart and Mia Lulukisin and Sharon, who's also here from our collaborative, for being here. Let's see if I can make this work. Oh, yes. I have no relationships that I want to tell you about or to disclose. However, I must disclose that I have 58 slides and 12 minutes, more or less. I'm not going to go in detail on all 58 slides. So think of this as a kind of musical piece with movements. There's going to be some slow and some fast. And that's really about the only movement thing I'm going to do, because we're focused a lot more on food and nutrition. So bear with me. Okay, we're going to talk about the Kellogg Food and Fitness Program, the HOPE vision, the reality of Oakland that we're trying to address, something about our assessment methodology, how we're looking at the problem, and how we're doing our planning. The Kellogg Food and Fitness Program started about 2 years ago now. The vision from the Kellogg Foundation is to create vibrant communities to provide equitable access to affordable, healthy, locally grown food and safe and inviting places for physical activity and play. The funding is an initial period for planning, 2.5 years of funding, 5 years subsequently for implementation, and 3 years of sustainability funding. So it's over 10 years of funding if we meet all of our benchmarks, which is a very unusual funding situation, as you know. There are 9 sites around the country: Seattle, Oakland, the Tohono O'odham Reservation in Arizona, Northeast Iowa, Detroit, Michigan, Holyoke, Massachusetts, Boston, New York City, and Philadelphia. For those of you who do not know California, Oakland is on the left coast of the United States, on the right side of San Francisco Bay. We're the only city in the world that has this beautiful view of San Francisco all the time. Our vision for the HOPE Collaborative is to create vibrant neighborhoods that provide equitable access to affordable, healthy, locally grown food, safe and inviting places for physical activity and play, and sustainable, successful local economies, all to the benefit of the families and youth living in Oakland's most vulnerable neighborhoods, those suffering the greatest impact from health disparities. So our current reality is that we're a city that's divided. The red line is both symbolic and actually real. It divides the city in 2 parts. On the right side of the line is the Oakland Hills, and on the left side of the line is the Oakland Flatlands. Health inequities have their most severe impact on the flatlands. The dark brown spaces in the top slide are where the mortality rate in Oakland is the highest, and the brown spaces in the bottom slide are where the high school graduation rate is the lowest. So these kinds of disparities map onto income, race, and ethnicity. Most people of color live on the west side of 580. Most poverty is located west of 580, childhood poverty, and household units without vehicles. We can put those in numbers. Almost 75% of Oakland's population lives west of 580 in the flatlands. Almost 80% are people of color. And the median household income is half of what it is in the foothills, and the poverty rate's twice of what it is in the hills. So this is a severe sort of state of disparity. There are a wide range of other disparities in terms of access to parks and recreation, lack of transit options, infrastructure deficiencies, public safety concerns, violence, people not being able to afford the cost of recreational facilities, on high levels of pollution, diesel emissions, etc. The health inequities associated with these disparities are what you might expect: lower life expectancy, higher prevalence of type 2 diabetes, higher asthma rates, higher rates of obesity, and higher rates of death and injury from violence. So we've been working on planning to address these issues, and We've looked at some questions that we need to answer. The first being, what other assessments were done before we got started? What did they find? What gaps are there? What land use patterns could support food and fitness systems change? What food is accessible at the neighborhood level? Do people actually cook in the flatlands? And how much money do people spend for food? And what food and fitness conditions do neighborhood residents, our primary stakeholders in this process, actually want and need? So our assessment methodology, we've used two approaches. One is we call meta-analysis and the other microzone assessment. In terms of meta-analysis, that's a formal in-depth review of assessments done in the city of Oakland over the last 5 years. We commissioned three of those, one for three main areas, food and food systems, built environment, and local sustainable economic development. And we included family and youth factors in each one. The findings we're just beginning to look at, but basically those studies did not look at food systems issues in the area of Oakland that is our primary target area. In terms of built environment, the major finding was that crime prevents people from using, from being outside and doing physical activity and play. In terms of microzone assessment, these are in-depth assessments that we do on our own, doing our own research. We use something we call a walk-the-block visual inventory, where we look at land use, streets and sidewalks, parks and playgrounds. We map those findings. We look at the food stores. We have an index corner that we where there's a grocery store, a corner store. We look at the products, the prices, the quality. We take that data and extrapolate to aggregate consumer expenditures for food. We look at the types of businesses, business ownership. We talk to people on the streets. We do focus groups or listening sessions and design threats and a household survey. This map shows the six areas in the flatland, or seven that we're actually looking at. And where the arrow is this area here. We're going to talk a little bit about some of our findings. That's 98th and Eads. It's a place with no sidewalks. Some of the demographics, there's a little over 4,000 people who live there, and they have the same profile as other areas in the flatland, only a little bit more so. In terms of food access, that lower slide shows you the entire fruits and vegetables available to the people in 4,000 people who live at 98th and Eads. There's some onions and potatoes on the other side of that little aisle, but that's about it. Built environment, there's a large Federal Express depot down the street, so there's lots of 18-wheelers that drive up and down Eads. Streets and sidewalks are in bad conditions, and there's razor wire, as you can see. There's a park and recreation center, which is a little bit of a distance away. There's large, there's high noise and pollution levels, et cetera. Most of the housing is residential in yellow. There's some industrial area in purple and a few businesses. Most of those are liquor stores, a couple grocery stores. And the lady in the bottom right would like to have a laundromat because she has 11 children and has no place to do her laundry. In terms of doing the listening sessions, we ask people if they cook at home. And this is an important point, which we found backed up also by our household survey. People in the flatlands cook at home. Poor people of color cook, and they cook quite regularly. And in fact, they cook perhaps more than people who are wealthier at home. Where do they shop? Well, sometimes they shop in the neighborhood stores, but mostly they have to travel some distance to go to the grocery stores, the supermarkets that are not located in the flatlands. In all of the flatlands, almost 300,000 people, there's basically two supermarkets. All the rest of the food is through corner stores. So they can't get the food they want in their neighborhoods, and it's costly. As I mentioned, our survey backs that up. So this is a first little footnote here on food justice that we want to make a point about. We find, in contrast to the stereotype, that people do cook at home, and they do want fresh, healthy food. However, as you know, they're confined to living in neighborhoods without nearby real food stores because of public and private policy choices that essentially represent systemic and structural barriers to access to food. So we don't use the term food deserts anymore because that suggests a pretty place that's where you go take pictures and there's flowers in the springtime and that's a natural phenomena. We talk about townships in Oakland that have apartheid through food. This is not an accident and it's not natural. Okay, so in spite of the fact that there's these conditions, how much do people spend on food? Just focus on the bottom line in the yellow space down there. The closest supermarket to 98th and Eads, if people shop there all year round for just 20 food products, they would spend $1,260 a year for food. Why do we choose those 20 food products? If you look at this line here, you can see that according to the Consumer Expenditure Survey that's done by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, people, no matter what race, ethnicity, or income class, spend between 64 and 69% of their food expenditures for food at home for those basic food products. So we've surveyed all the supermarkets where people have to go shop, and we find, again, bottom line, the median is that people spend about $1,300 a year per person for those 20 basic food products. What does that mean? The people in the Flatlands spend $369 million a year for 20 basic food items. That's a lot of money. And we believe that that's large enough of an expenditure to be an economic engine or an engine for economic growth. And so we're beginning to plan, our economic development work based on those items. So I'm going to skip this food. We can produce all that food locally is the bottom line. The local economic impact based on regional multipliers, if we capture just 20% of consumer expenditures for those basic food items, we generate new income of $148 million a year for the Flatlands and 148 new jobs. We've begun to look at what this might look like in terms of designing it, and we're beginning to do the business planning. And we actually have a store that's been located at 98th and Eads that the city of Oakland purchased, and we're beginning to think about acquiring that store and making it be our first food store. In terms of play and physical activity, we're beginning to think if we build it, they actually may not come because people's primary concern is public safety in the neighborhoods. So we have to begin to think of policies that make the social and psychological space in the neighborhood safe and attractive. We have to think about other kinds of neighborhood-based businesses for basic goods and services in the neighborhood. We've continually add new questions to what we're trying to understand in terms of local ownership and jobs and young people's involvement, community ownership of policy and planning, et cetera. We're beginning to think of policies we need to make the opportunities real. And the first one on that list is access to capital for local ownership, neighborhood-based business ownership development. We do have a policy process in place. We've identified over 99 policies that affect food and fitness that we want to look at, and we have a policy screening tool. And we're beginning to do action planning to do outreach and engagement to make sure that what we do responds to the needs of Oakland's, the residents of these neighborhoods. These are our primary stakeholders, as I mentioned. We continue to talk and do a variety of different meeting formats and engaging people. This is the typical planning structure with a steering committee. We have a steering committee that's sort of the final word, and action teams and primary stakeholders at the bottom of that hierarchy. We're turning it upside down. We want to do what we call bottom-down planning with the ideas and decisions about what should happen in the neighborhoods coming from neighborhood residents. In terms of our planning process, we're thinking we have to stop doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. We cannot do what we've always done and expect to get something different. We have to begin to do things that have not been done before, and we have to respond to the expressed wants and needs of neighborhood residents. We're doing what some people call building the bridge as we walk on it. We're trying to go someplace that doesn't exist right now, which is always scary. And we have a preferential option for the poor, which is a word or phrase that I draw from Paul Farmer's work, Pathologies of Power. And we're working hard to sustain healthy collaborative relationships that will lead to systemic change. We're all partners end up realizing that for change to happen, we have to make space for change, which means everyone has to give up some of what they already have, some power. So how do we make this work in the real world? How do we integrate policies and practices for real systemic change? Before I go through this last slide, I just want to mention one of the things that came to me recently is the idea that one of the problems with the food system and the industrial food system is that it produces toxic food. And if you think of the industrial food system as pouring toxic substances into the food stream, we have a food stream that's like a contaminated water supply. Who knows the name John Snow, Sir John Snow? Yeah, you all knew that because you're public health people. As you know, John Snow mapped the water supply of London in the middle 1800s and convinced officials to take the handle off the pump of the contaminated well and stop the cholera epidemic. We think we need to take the handle off the pump of the industrial food system. We need policies and practices that create systemic change in both the food system and in vulnerable neighborhoods. And I'm beginning to think, and we've been talking about this, and I think we are beginning to think, that we need to make this change happen through our youth. And we need to ask, how do we get the youth to build the stores? How do we get the youth to own the stores, have the jobs, advocate, and learn how to advocate, as one of our youth, Corinne Merle, was doing this afternoon at her own poster session. Making sure that the youth learn how to do all these things, create their own Oakland for the future, and become Oakland's new leaders. We think we can achieve our goals if we do that. Thank you.
Any questions for Hank before we open it up for general questions? Yeah, over there.
The question was about public safety. The meta-analyses show that from previous studies. In our own focus groups, the first thing people say to us when we ask, where do you take your children and your family for play, they say, we don't. It's too dangerous. There was a question over here.
You mentioned that you found that people in Oakland were, in fact, cooking at home.
Yes. We haven't done that yet, no.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay, any questions for any of our panelists today? Yes, over here. Okay, well, I think I'm going to close out the session, and I want to thank all of our panelists for wonderful presentations. Thank you very much.
I have thought about that in connection with much. Oh, gosh. It's hard not to.
Right,
you know, they came in and they set it up.